Hello, Nick. Hi, it's Jeremy Shapiro calling.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Welcome to Stir the Pots.
thank you.
Generally, I ask all sorts of questions, and my first usually is, how did you become a pastry chef?
Oh, well, I don't know. That's hard to say. Uh-huh. When I was a child, my maternal grandmother lived with us. She loved to bake, so she baked every day. And I don't really think that, well, I know I never, you know, learned a particular recipe from her or anything. But, you know, the idea of being around a lot of baking early in life and enjoying it gave me the impetus to try some things on my own as a teenager. And then beyond that, I decided after college, rather than to go to graduate school, I went to culinary school.
Uh-huh. And what were you studying before you became a pastry
chef? I was studying French.
Oh, okay, that's not too bad. It's not far off.
Actually, it came in handy because since I was, involved in modern languages to begin with, I took some Italian, I took some German. I already had Spanish in elementary school, so, you know, a lot of that helps.
It definitely does, yeah. Since American system of measurement is pretty awful when you're doing pastry, do you use grams or do you do it American measurement?
No, I mean, since what I write is mostly for consumers, I don't agree, you know. I mean, if you have the kind of a scale that you could buy in a cookware store, uh-huh, it's definitely no more accurate, no more accurate than if you measure carefully by volume.
Right. And how is it different teaching, the average consumer rather than, like, say, students who want to become professionals in the industry?
Well, it's two completely different types of instruction because career training instruction is pretty much technique-oriented. You know, the students might cover one technique for preparing a kind of dough or batter and then do some variations on that. Whereas avocational baking classes are more topic-driven. So, you know, there might be six or eight chocolate desserts or... You know, so it's a little bit more all over the place. In some ways, it's even more challenging because we really don't have any control over the skill level of people who come. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, it's a lot of fun, and people enjoy themselves. And I keep saying over and over, you got to read the recipe, and sometimes I think I'm talking Martian because not everybody does, but... I mean, that's a big part of it.
Well, I know as a professional, I've pretty much been a cook all my life, but I always thought it was important to know all facets of, the skill of being a chef, but also pastry, because I really loved it. And I forced myself to learn and threw myself into a pastry shop and learned the really hard way with people. And pastry chefs, I think, you know, are a little different than regular chefs in a sense. I think they're very secretive.
Pastry chefs are irregular chefs.
Yeah, yeah.
I see.
Yeah. What's the best way to pursue a career in pastry for, let's say, budding students or...
You know, I think school is always a good introduction. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I have to say that some long-term culinary schools have become really expensive.
Yeah.
I've been associated with first Peter Kumpf's and now the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. It's going to be 25 years soon. We've always felt that short-term courses that give students the basics, give them the vocabulary they need to be able to work in a restaurant, pastry shop, hotel, etc., really work very well. And, nowadays, the economy being what it is, nobody really has an extra couple of $50,000 bills to throw around. So I think short-term instruction is pretty good. When young kids or when parents of young kids come to me and ask what their kids should do, I always say they should get a degree first. I think that's, you know, that's really good, because no one is going to stay, you know, stay standing in front of the bench for their whole life. And I don't believe in culinary schools granting academic degrees. You know, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't go to a potato farm to buy a truffle. You know, it's just, it's not the same thing. Culinary schools should confer culinary diplomas and right. certificates or whatever there is, and academic institutions should confer academic degrees.
Well, I asked a lot of pastry chefs and chefs alike whether it's possible to have like a system like they have in Europe of apprenticeship. What do you think about that?
Well, that somewhat exists already here in the United States through the American Culinary Federation. In certain parts of the country where ACF is very strong, they do run apprenticeship programs where kids work in a restaurant for a few days a week, and they also, I guess, have time off to attend classes in, you know, at maybe a junior college or something like that, one day a week, which is kind of similar to what the European system is. The difference, I guess, lies in the fact that, I really don't know exactly what the French system is, but I wrote an article a couple of years ago for Pastry Art and Design magazine about this Richemont Professional Pastry School in Lucerne.
Yeah.
And part of what they do is they train the people that are known as apprentice masters, which is to say that if you have, for example, a pastry shop and you want to be able to have apprentices come and work into your in your establishment, you have to have a trained apprentice master on the premises who is responsible for the formation of those kids, and that it's just not, you know, a haphazard thing, so that they are learning a thought-out curriculum of things while they're working, too, as opposed to it just in that one day a week when they go to class.
What do you think are some of the differences or similarities in cooking and pastry?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people say, oh, baking is a science, and, you know, oh, you have to be careful when you measure it. Well, you know, I think cooking and baking are very much identical in that respect. I mean, first of all, everything is a science. You know, putting on your shoes, you know, you have principles of physics that have to do with how the leather stretches when it goes around your foot. So saying that baking is science doesn't really, well, it's not saying anything, you know. And saying that you have to be careful when you measure when you're baking but not when you're cooking is also a fallacy, because you can't make soup with a chicken and a half a gallon of water and 3 pounds of salt. You know, you have to measure that accurately. Of course, the difference between cooking and baking lies in the fact that usually when we measure for cooking, we measure by eye. Oh, I think I'll throw in another carrot. This one looks kind of puny, so maybe I'll add another one. So, as opposed to baking, where you measure by volume or you measure by weight, depending upon what you're doing, and you get, you know, you get accurate results. Of course, even baking formulas, though, all have a certain tolerance built into them where, you know, if you're making creme anglaise and you throw in a couple of ounces too much or too little sugar, it's not going to really make that big a difference. I remember I was making a sponge cake recipe that I make all the time, and I was increasing it. And I was kind of rushing, and I was making three times the quantity of the recipe. And I realized that when I was finished, and I looked at the ingredients that were on the bench, I put in three times the quantity of the eggs and only two times the quantity of everything else. And then, of course, I ran to the oven and I said, it's kind of interesting. They don't look any different from the way they always do.
So there's a happy mistake.
Sometimes yeah. happens like that. But, you know, the notion that you have to stand there with an eyedropper, you know, when you're baking something, I think that's, you know, that traumatizes people more than anything else, I think. It makes them scared of baking.
There's a lot of trends in kitchens, and I'm wondering in, like, pastry, how that affects, like, the base of skills that are learned that you really have to, you know, kind of, you know, there's, like, those like, you know, the creme anglaise or the genoise or something. Do all these new kind of trends in baking science change what we've learned, and will that affect, you know, the traditional
I think sorts you have to be a little more specific about a particular thing.
Okay.
Is there something particular you had in mind?
Well, you know, there's sort of like all molecular sort of new gels and strange kind of chemical things that they're putting into pastries now to kind of change the structure of like a fruit or something, you know.
Right, but I all right, pastry, you know, yeah, I understand what you mean.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, I recently had a dessert that was a deconstructed lemon meringue pie, and it was a lemon cream mixture that was like a lemon curd, but interestingly enough, was gelled when it was hot, but then was liquid when it was cold. So exactly the opposite of what we normally expect. So that was served hot in a cube kind of in the center of the plate. The crust was a really delicious cookie dough that had ground almonds in it. But after the crust was baked, it was ground up into crumbs.
Uh-huh.
And those were sprinkled around. And the meringue was also very delicious. It was a cooked meringue. And I think just in order to add a little color and also to introduce a further note of flavor, the meringue was flavored with a puree of basil. And, you know, there was also a little bit of a boysenberry or blueberry syrup, maybe, that was part of it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was a perfectly fine dessert. I think a good lemon meringue pie could stand shoulder to shoulder with it.
Yeah.
But there was nothing wrong with trying this kind of innovative approach to it. And I think a lot of people are too quick to condemn some of these wild things that people are doing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not how people eat, right? That's a special occasion thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, remember just somebody asking Jacques Pepin at a class once when he was making some particularly elaborate thing and said, well, you know, when you cook for yourself, or he said, when I cook for myself, I roast a chicken and make a salad just like you do. So, and you know, that's the reality of it.
Yeah.
But it's a very important, and I certainly do not either make fun of or, what am I trying to say, you know, not have confidence in people who are trying new things, because if nobody ever tries anything new, there won't ever be anything different.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and people take false steps along the way.
Kind of like nouveau cuisine was condemned.
Exactly. Everybody was screaming, oh, Nouvelle Cuisine, what a horror. And there are many things that, you know, Nouvelle Cuisine certainly did not survive intact.
Yeah.
We don't put kiwis on our veal cutlets anymore. But, you know, there are a lot of valuable things that came out of Nouvelle Cuisine that kind of formed part of the way people cook and eat.
Yeah, so everything's sort of an evolution then.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, you know, there must have been a day when apple pie was an innovation, right?
Yeah, sure. What's your relationship with Switzerland? I want to know because my sister lives there, and I go there often, and I love the desserts and bread and stuff there. So what's your connection with Switzerland?
Well, actually, when I graduated from culinary school way back 4,000 years ago in 1973, I went to Switzerland to make an apprenticeship, and I stayed on for a while, and I just visited frequently after that until I started doing a lot of writing. And one of the writing things that I did early on was I used a lot of the material that I had gathered during my year or so of living there and, subsequent visits. And I remember I got in touch with the consulate because I was having a lot of trouble working out the spelling for a couple of things, because the German-speaking part of Switzerland speaks a dialect of German that's from the Middle Ages,
right.
And it's not just one dialect, it's 60 dialects. So not everybody agrees on how some of the traditional things should be written or spelled. So they put me in touch with some people at Switzerland Tourism, which is the official tourist office of the country. And I stayed in touch with them. And I guess around the end of the 90s, some people I knew there contacted me, and they wanted to do a food and wine promotion program, part of which was going to be a newsletter about eating and drinking in Switzerland that was going to be on their website in the United States every month. So they hired me to do it. So I did that for about 6 years. It was a lot of fun. I went to Switzerland 3 or 4 times a year and ate and drank and visited and slept and, did all sorts of stuff and wrote about it. And so now I still occasionally, since I write for a bunch of different publications, since I'm very familiar with a lot of places there, they wind up in things that I write, too.
And what region of Switzerland were you predominantly trained?
I worked in Zurich when I went over the first time.
And what do you see in Swiss desserts or pastries that are different than, let's say, like German or French? Are there a lot of similarities, or they have a distinct...
I think the Swiss are probably the original inventors of fusion. They take what they like out of what they adapt, and they make it into their own.
Yeah.
I remember somebody saying to me, oh, you're writing about Swiss food? Well, wait a minute, isn't that just like German in the north and Austrian in the east and French in the west and Italian in the south? I said, there's this one little village that's right in the middle of the country that's equidistant from all of those places, and that's where the real Swiss food is. And they said to me, oh, really? Do you know the name of it?
Yeah, my sister will bake, like Basel Leckerli.
Uh-huh.
But she does her country version of it, and she said, oh, it's not the city version. So there's like a little backstory, I guess, for every kind of food place you go, there's like...
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
And, whenever you cross a national border, no matter, like the French risotto that's spelled with a Z, it has absolutely nothing to do with how they make risotto in Italy.
Yeah.
The French use long grain rice for it. It's usually something which is cooked rice that's, suspended in some kind of a thickened sauce.
Yeah.
It's just not the same thing.
Yeah.
So why would anybody think that, going from Milan to Lugano, which is about an hour by car, that the food was going to be exactly the same? It's not.
How different is it to write a recipe for a book than teaching in a classroom?
Well, obviously, you know, when you're teaching a recipe, you don't need to put in every detail because people are going to see you make it. So that's one thing that makes the writing a little bit faster. Then again, recipes that I choose for teaching might even be a little bit more elaborate sometimes than the ones that wind up in a book. Uh-huh. But you know what? What's in a book has to really have all of the information and not leave any guesswork.
Right. Can you copyright a recipe?
Well, an individual recipe is not copyrightable. Only the contents of a book are copyrightable.
Okay.
And as such, if somebody reproduces your recipe in another book word for word, then that's taken to be plagiarism. But it's really hard. I mean, I had a circumstance recently where somebody pretty much adapted my very quick puff pastry recipe of making the pretty much everything in the food processor.
Right.
And down to even the dimensions that the dough has to be rolled out to. And, you know, I complained to the legal department of the publisher who had done the book that the recipe appeared in, and their feeling, I think, was, well, you know, what are the thousands and thousands of dollars in legal fees that we would have to pay to pursue this going to get us?
Yeah.
You know, because it's not as though the book that it was in sold a million books, so, you know, they could get any kind of real damages for it, so they elected not to pursue it. But it was an obvious case.
Do you think that recipes intrinsically are just elaborations of other things that people have done or just changed a little bit?
Well, I mean, they can be, and if they are, then you should state it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've always done that. I have 8,000 cookbooks, so I look up recipes for things that are unusual sometimes and adapt them for a book, but I say that. The books that I have aren't available to everybody who would buy one of my books. Therefore, the fact that I include that recipe is something they wouldn't be able to access without having it in my book.
Right. What do you think about food TV? Is it a good way of teaching people how to cook, or is it just entertainment?
I think pretty much now, a lot of it has... Now it's very personality driven, it seems, and you know, everybody's got to be quirky,
yeah,
in some way or another, or you know, have one of these LCD type personalities where they appeal to the people who enjoy watching them but are never going to cook anything. But when you move away from the Food Network and then you go to some of the PBS cooking shows, you know, those can be very instructive. My old friend Sarah Moulton has a wonderful show on PBS that's called, I think it's called Weekday Meals. And, you know, she gives you the information you need to be able to reproduce the dish. It's not about using cute little terms or telling you about her trip to Paris. It's about telling you how to cook what she's making.
What do you think about New York being like sort of considered the capital of food and the state of pastry arts in the city? Because it seems like we're losing a lot of pastry shops. There's less and less places of choice, I think, unless I'm really misinformed.
Well, a lot of the old line places are disappearing. I think that's true.
Yeah.
Some of those, I think, were surviving on reputations from a long time ago, maybe that were, you know, presently undeserved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had some cousins come over to visit from New Jersey, and they wanted to go to the San Gennaro feast, so we went down there, and we stopped in at a pastry shop in Little Italy that has been there, and it's not Ferraris.
Yeah.
That has been there for, I'm sure this place has been there for 75 or 100 years, and I went up to the case and I saw that they had some pastries that, you know, were finished off with whipped cream or filled with whipped cream, which is kind of not very Italian to begin with. And also the cream wasn't cream. It was non-dairy whipped topping. So, you know, you can tell cream never has that dead white color.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that's unfortunate. I mean, people who go to a place like that and, you know, no one goes to a place like that if they're not in kind of a celebrating mood. You know, the neighborhood people don't go in there.
Yeah.
So there's no reason why they can't use good ingredients and charge what they need to for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's too bad. And, you know, there have been a lot of places like that that have disappeared around. I live in Greenwich Village, so I've seen that. And, you know, I remember this is one place on 6th Avenue that the food was not only awful, but it was kind of dirty. And they closed eventually, and I remember talking to somebody in the neighborhood and said, oh, you know, the Thus and Such Bakery closed. And I said, oh, thank heaven.
Yeah, because I always tell people how in Europe, you know, you could go anywhere. There's still bakeries everywhere. And here it seems like, you know, either it's wholesale or you have to pay really a lot to go to like a more boutique-y kind of style place. So there's not that really home feel anymore of desserts being made here, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, it depends, too. I you know, outside of big urban centers, I think there are small bakeries still.
Yeah.
And ones that are being started by people who are interested in going into the business now. You know, the problem with the bakery business is unless you do an enormously high volume, it's very difficult to make any money because of the enormous amount of labor that's attached to everything.
Yeah, so there's no more real dream of mom and pop anymore.
Not unless mom and pop just want to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what it amounts to.
Yeah, it's kind of an idealistic dream to have that, but maybe it's not a modern way of life anymore.
A little bit less so, that's true,
I think.
And the other thing that also makes it prohibitively expensive here is that, you know, we don't have that organized apprenticeship system
right. Where
you can have, you know, kids that are learning who make a very minimal salary do some of the repetitive and simple work that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So, that's I think, one of the things that makes it possible to have establishments like that in Europe because of the, you know, the state-supervised apprenticeship systems.
Mm. What's your favorite medium to work in, chocolate or fruit?
You know, I don't really. It's hard to have a favorite when you do it all the time,
yeah. You
know?
Okay. Well, then I might be redundant, but what's your favorite dessert?
Oh, yeah. Well, I could tell you my 1,000 favorite desserts.
Okay. Who inspires you today in the patisserie field?
Well, I think inspiration comes from a lot of different places, you know, not necessarily other people who are doing the same kind of stuff.
Right.
But I will say, though, that among the people whose work I get a chance to see in New York, I think the person who is the most impressive and the most technically sound, and also, you know, somebody who's very modest and not trying to shove the fact that he's a genius down your throat is Michael Lasconis, the pastry chef at Le Bernardin.
Yeah.
Who makes some really incredible things and also has, he has a blog that I read occasionally. He is very articulate and very, 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 very intelligent. If there were If somebody should get an honorary PhD for pastry making, I think he should be the first recipient.
What is your next project going to be? Another book, or do you have other
My next
things?
project is going to be taking my out-of-print Italian dessert book that was published in 1990 and doing a very much revised and expanded version of it.
I have that book. I've done several recipes out of it. That's what I've always found really great about your books is like they're really easy to do, the desserts, even the one the fine dessert book pastry book that you have, which is great because the Delta Town recipe is fantastic, flawless. And I've always found your books don't have like mistakes or things like left out where you kind of go, what happened? What did I do wrong? So they're a joy to use and read.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and
All right. Thank you, Jeremy.
have a good
Bye.
day. Bye.